welcome to Know More, Raise More, the podcast for fundraising professionals, where we share firsthand stories from donors and gift officers who have real relationships, working together to change the world for good. I'm your host, Jennifer Trammell. On the podcast today, we know so many of our listeners are fundraising in higher ed and working with alumni, so we're headed back to college. Ed Berman graduated from Drexel University in 1974 with 17 job offers. But something happened during his time as an undergrad.
But that just left a bad taste in my mouth.
What do you do when one of your alums, or a potential donor for any organization, has had a bad experience? Development Director Tom Zuleski joins us with an amazing turnaround story. How he turned four decades of dissatisfaction into a six-figure bequest. It's a model you can follow too. Know More, Raise More, the podcast for fundraising professionals, is brought to you by Insightful. Insightful helps improve engagement between nonprofit organizations and donors. We know connecting with donors is hard. Insightful helps fundraisers like you better know your donors so you can raise more money, advance your mission, and do more good in the world. Ed, welcome to Know More, Raise More, the podcast for fundraising professionals.
Thank you.
Will you tell us a little bit about your life growing up and what ultimately led you to Drexel?
So I was born in South Philadelphia, spent time in West Philadelphia, and ended up in the near Northeast Philadelphia, but always in the city. It was, you go outside and there's 12 other kids outside and you grab a ball of whatever season you're in and you spend your life playing sports. So great way to grow up. Didn't have a lot, but we didn't know we didn't have a lot. I went to an all-academic magnet school in Philadelphia, so I was doing the college prep thing. Because in my family, the objective or the learnings were, you are going to go to college. You are going to get an education, because none of us did. And their objective was to make it better for their kids. My grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. So it was, you're going to go to school. We don't know how we're going to pay for it, but you're going to go to school. And so, you know, that was the mantra in my family, and we knew it. So we all worked hard, all 10 cousins on that side of the family. The Drexel thing was interesting because I had an older cousin who married a guy who went to Drexel and was a chemical engineer. And he was 5 years older than me. So he passed out of Drexel as I came in, but he was a great guy. Got to know him very well when I was in high school. I guess you would say I looked up to him, if you will. And I said, I want to be like that. You know, he was a good looking guy, always dressed well, had some money, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, always said, wanted that. And at the same time in high school, the teacher that I had that resonated with me the most probably was my chemistry teacher. So good at math, good at chemistry, had a role model of someone that came out of Drexel as a chemical engineer. So I said, I can do that. I should do that. That's what headed me towards engineering, number one. And if you're a Philadelphia kid, you know Drexel's a good school. In those years, Drexel was one of the only two schools, I think, in the country that had co-op as a part of their formal education program. So you said, okay, well, if I'm going to go to school, and I know that I'm not going to get a whole lot of support from the family financially, co-op is a pretty good thing. Not only do you get the benefit of having a sense of what kind of jobs you're going to go into when you get out of school, you get some practical experience, you get to earn some decent money. So those two things combined made me target Drexel.
Knowing that your family wasn't able to offer a lot of support, how did you pull this together?
They offered me financial aid scholarships. And between that and what I had already saved from, you know, working, you know, in jobs before college. In fact, an early job I had was I actually sold soft drinks at Eagles games at Franklin Field back in the day. So I was always doing something, always working, always trying to make some money as a kid. So between all of that and the co-op money and a little bit of student loans that I could take out, I could make that happen. I could make it work. I started out as a kid who grew up in, you know, late 60s. So I showed up with long hair, shoulder length hair, you know, went through my first year at Drexel that way until it came time to interview for co-op jobs. And then that required me to look a little different and act a little different, cut my hair, figure out how to wear a suit and all that kind of thing. And, but it all worked. My first co-op assignment, my only co-op actually company was with Mobil Oil. And my first assignment was at 42nd and Lexington in New York City, which was an adventure. I chose to take the summer off and play baseball one more year trying to be discovered. And I kind of was. I was approached by the Red Sox in those years. But believe it or not, the money that a chemical engineer could make coming out of school was more than the minimum salary in the Major League in baseball. So I said, I know where the money's going to be. I'm going to go be an engineer. Stupid move. Free agency happened a couple years later. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, it all worked out. So on my 19th birthday, I show up in New York City, moved into an apartment with four other Drexel guys in Queens. But it was just a fascinating experience, a chance to, at a very, very young, relatively young age, or very, very young age, get a sense of what engineering could be all about. And the neat thing about co-op is you're doing real work. It's not like you're doing grunt work. You're actually doing real work. So I was, as a neophyte engineer, I was working on the design of their refinery in Torrance, California, as an example.
So you have this great work experience with co-op. You're back at Drexel doing classes on campus. Tell us about that time in your life and any changes that were happening.
In the second, maybe early third year at Drexel, they changed the financial aid package. Arbitrarily, well, I don't know what was behind it in all fairness, but in my mind, arbitrarily, but it was reduced. And it wasn't just me, other guys in the class that, you know, we all compared notes and same thing kind of happened. And there was no change in my parents' financial situation, no ability for them to contribute more. I was making what I was making at co-op. So there was nothing fundamentally that changed my ability to fund my education, but yet the support was reduced. You made it work because you went out and took more student loans, which the kids today would laugh at in terms of the amounts of loans that we took out relative to what they do today. But nonetheless, it was real money back then. So we took out more, all of us took out more student loans. That's what got me through. And the education was great. The experience was great. Got a ton of job offers coming out of school, chose the one that I wanted, which led me to, you know, a nice career, nice life. But that just left a bad taste in my mouth. That at that point in time in my, it was almost a bait and switch. I hate to use that term, but you know, the offer was made, the support was there, got me in, I was far enough along, and then it was reduced. So even though I got a good education, got a lot of job offers, had a great job coming out of school, it just left a bad taste. And I can't speak for anybody else, but in my mouth, certainly, as I moved out of Drexel.
From there, Ed started his life. He had 17 job offers coming out of Drexel, and he went to work for DuPont.
They offered me a job in Houston, Texas, which in the 70s was booming. It was a great place to be young. And they offered me the opportunity to participate in a program for high potential people. So every 2 years, I would move on to a different job. And after 7 years, I realized, well, you know, I was decent in engineering, but I didn't really love it. I was much better, I thought, at the business side of things. And DuPont luckily gave me a chance to move into the sales and marketing side. And that's when my career took off.
Hey, there's a big change happening right now affecting fundraisers like you. Over the next decade, up to $70 trillion will shift from aging baby boomers to millennials. And this wealth transfer is already underway. So are you prepared to work with millennials? Start by downloading Insightful's free ebook, 9 Insights Fundraisers Need to Know to Prepare for Millennial Major Donors. Just head to insightfulphilanthropy.com/ebook. Go to insightfulphilanthropy.com/ebook to get the 9 things you need to know about millennials from millennials. That's insightfulphilanthropy.com/ebook. Hey, one more thing. If you're enjoying learning from guests like Ed and Tom, leave us a 5-star rating in your podcast app. And make sure you click subscribe or follow so you'll know right away when a new episode of Know More, Raise More drops. And now back to our conversation.
So during this time, were you engaged with Drexel at all?
Not at all. Not at all. I was so focused on, I got married right out of school, as people tended to do back in those years. So I was so focused on my career and moving around and my wife's career and, trying to match her needs with my needs as we moved to wherever the next location was. Didn't even pay Drexel any attention. So I didn't experience Drexel, didn't interact, didn't come back, didn't talk to anybody. Maintain friendships with some of the guys I graduated with, but that's about it.
What started to change?
So fast forward about 30 years, maybe. And I ended up here in Scottsdale, Arizona. Someone at Drexel reached out to me, someone in their fundraising organization. No pressure, just wanted to, he was going to be in town. Wanted to sit down and, talk to me, introduce himself, get to know me, a little bit, whatever it was. So I said, sure. I said, he just wanted to have a cup of coffee. We had breakfast once, but we just had that first meeting, first engagement. Didn't ask for anything, didn't try to close the sale, if you will, and try to raise any money for me at that time. And then the next time he was in town, a year later, he followed up. And then he followed up again. He was just trying to rekindle or build some kind of relationship between myself and Drexel again. He left, moved on from Drexel. There was another gentleman that was involved that picked up the relationship, if you will. Same thing, had breakfast, had coffee. Also never really pushed me for anything, for any commitment. I explained the situation and how, I wasn't really yet ready to commit to anything because of what happened is still, whether it was right, wrong, or indifferent, just still wasn't sitting right with me and kept building it and building it. And from our conversations, I finally realized, maybe I was looking back in the past a little too much, being a little bit intransigent, a little too sensitive. And we started seriously talking about how we might get involved with Drexel, how we might do something. So Tom's the guy to turn that around.
So let me introduce Tom Zaleski. Tom, great to have you join us here. Tell us about your role at Drexel and how you came to know Ed and that relationship building.
Yeah, well, first off, thank you for having me, Ed. It's always a pleasure to speak and see you. Jennifer, you as well. I am the Director of Development for the College of Engineering and our School of Biomedical Engineering at Drexel University. As Ed had said, I inherited the Arizona territory. We are a pretty territory-based group within the College of Engineering. There's myself and three or four other gift officers. So Arizona is a territory of mine, and the former gift officer, Chris, had it. And they said, hey, Tom, you're going to take Arizona, take a look at who's out there, try and schedule a trip and kind of go from there. And then Ed's name popped up and I noticed that he had a relationship. And I was looking in our database and our records that we have. And I said, you know what? I don't really know what's here. I came into the mindset, let me reach out to Ed. Let me see if he wants to have a coffee. I know it may be the same old thing he's been doing with the other two gift officers, but I wanted to sort of reset the conversation. I came into that mindset of let's reset this. I don't know a single thing about Ed. I want to know more about him. I want to know what, if he's interested philanthropically. And then Ed did share with me, some of the what happened. I mean, the financial AIDS situation where it was reversed, and I felt his pain. Like I understood that, and that's very real, and it's not the first time I heard that from donors. And I just kind of never pushed that, and just really laid out to him what if he was ever interested in potentially giving a major gift or leaving a bequest in his estate. What are some options for him? Yeah, we have many different options. I thought the one thing that really kind of stuck out was our College of Engineering operation graduation. And what this does is this provides money for juniors and seniors, predominantly seniors, who are graduating and receive a financial hardship, maybe an unfortunate death of a parent or a natural disaster from where their parents live or where even they live, or if they got into a car accident or sick or whatever it may be. And this fund and this money provides, allows them to graduate and allows them to pay off that tuition bill or that book bill or whatever it may be. You know, Ed, if I recall, I believe I sort of laid it out to you and you kind of just sat back and thought about that. I was like, wow, like I never knew that kind of existed. And we just kind of had those conversations from there. And it sort of, I think, Ed, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think our, you know, the Philly sports, that connection. And this is like some advice I like to give to other gift officers is, you know, when it comes down to it, this is relationship building. This is getting to know somebody. This is getting to know not just, you know, why they chose to go to, you know, Drexel or whatever university it may be or college, but get to know the individual as a person. Get to know their, their family, if they're willing to share that. What's their interest? If it's sports, if it's not, if it's, you know, travel, cars, et cetera. And Ed, I'm trying to think. We really didn't talk philanthropy that much. I mean, we did some of the initial conversations. I mean, some of the nitty gritty, but it was just a real conversation, just how to get to know each other, really.
Well, I think that's right. In fact, but I mean, I knew why you were there, to be fair.
It's interesting you say that some people don't. And I think really? That's another navigating thing where, you know, I have to sort of navigate the conversation. I like to be upfront and honest and tell individuals, this is why I am coming. And I have that expectation. I am going to talk, you know, money and fundraising with you.
Absolutely.
There's some people who still, you know, and maybe they don't understand my title, they understand my role, or I'm not maybe explicit enough, but you'll be surprised. There's a lot of people who are kind of taken back when I get to that point of that conversation.
Really? They thought you were just coming into town to be nice and have a cup of coffee with them.
Yes.
So that's good. But the Philly sports thing is important. I mean, you grew up in Philadelphia. Even though I've lived in Chicago and New York and San Francisco and Melbourne, Australia, you always support the teams you grew up with. In fact, over my shoulder, there's an artist rendering of all four of the major Philadelphia sports teams with their old uniform colors.
Philly sports, the foundation of a great relationship. Remember, for insights on millennials from millennials, download Insightful's free ebook, 9 Insights Fundraisers Need to Know to Prepare for Millennial Major Donors. Just head to insightfulphilanthropy.com/ebook. Before we head back to the conversation, I have one ask for you. Who's another fundraiser or nonprofit leader you know who might enjoy this podcast? Share No More, Raise More with them as soon as you're done listening today. Thanks. Let's talk about what you were ultimately able to do together. Ed, you've now decided to make a gift to Drexel University.
I'm 70 years old now, believe it or not. It's hard to say that. I just turned 70. But, you know, some years ago, we started to get really serious, my wife and I, about, you know, where's it going to go, right? We're not going to spend it all. And COVID has put a damper on that because you can't travel as much as we were planning or would like to. But we started getting serious about it, and we're very lucky that I have a sister, she has a brother, they've done very well in their careers. They don't need our money. So we said, so what are we going to do with it? You know, with whatever's left, right? We decided that it's time for me to commit to supporting Drexel again and the program that exists and helping kids who may not be able to make it without some assistance really resonated with me. I don't have a need to have my name on a scholarship or I don't have enough money to have my name on a building, but, you know, that kind of thing. I don't need to be remembered that way. The fact that some kid who has some difficulty can make it through school because of something I'm able to do, that's enough. You know, that's enough. So we divided our estate up into 4 pieces. So half of it is going to be split between the two of us, half to my family, half to her family. We have nieces, no kids, so no grandkids. And the other half we're going to split as we wish. So the quarter that I'm controlling is going to go to Drexel, targeted for that fund. It's a number that has to be, that's yet undefined. So I've given Tom a minimum estimate, but it should be significantly more than that, you know, when it's all said and done. And if that's what's left of my life when I leave and I can help people, why not?
That's great. Tom, I'm thinking about these bequest gifts. This can be a really sensitive conversation. From your perspective, how does it usually go? How do you make people comfortable enough to talk about the time when they're not going to be here?
It's a really good question, and it is sensitive. You have to be wary. You have to understand who you're talking to. I like to ask the question, what do you want your legacy to be? Have you thought about your legacy? Have you thought about making a philanthropic investment into Drexel or the College of Engineering or the School of Biomedical Engineering? And many times I have individuals who sit back and kind of think about that. And like, you know, I never thought about that before. You know, what are the options? What can I do? And that's when I kind of can go into it and talk about some estate planning and estate giving and bequests and IRA rollovers or charitable remainder trust. I have a pretty good working knowledge of all of those, you know, vehicles. But, you know, when it comes down to it, sometimes I have to bring in our plan giving experts. And we have a very robust team at the plan giving office within Institutional Advancement at Drexel that I can call upon and bring in if needed to have a conversation, facilitate that conversation. It can be sensitive. You're talking about death. You have to kind of gauge. And my advice to individuals is don't be afraid to ask those questions. If that donor comes back and says, I don't want to talk about that, that's fine. You shut it down and you don't bring it up again. Or you can, maybe you bring it up later down the road, but at that time, no, you don't do it. But if they're open to the conversation, then I think it opens up a whole different world, because some individuals, you know, they may not have given before, but they don't have the cash or liquid assets available on hand currently to make it a large impact, a $25,000, you know, a year scholarship, or even a $5,000 a year. But, you know, they have money in an IRA or money in an estate or, you know, money sitting in an account that they don't know what to do with at the end. And they can make an impact now and see that impact while they're living. And they can be honored and sort of recognized for that if they so choose. That's pretty powerful.
That's really helpful, I think, for our fundraising listeners of how you approach that conversation.
Yeah, and I also, just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to ask the questions. I mean, we're fundraisers. Our number one task is to raise money. We have a couple of younger gift officers on the staff, and I tell them, don't be afraid to ask. You know, make that ask. Too many times, I think gift officers are afraid to ask and make the ask. I know that sounds kind of funny and weird, but I've heard that and I've seen it as well. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? You know, somebody says no.
Somebody says no. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. And you know what? And don't be discouraged. You know, this is part of that business. This is like that. People are going to say no. People are going to be upset with the university for some reason. Or they're just that the timing's not right. I mean, timing is everything. They do say timing is everything in life, and it truly is in a way. I've had multiple examples over the years where, you know, somebody's told me, "Hey, you know, time's not right. Come back to me now in 2 years." Sure enough, it is time. The time is right, and the time is fine. You know, maybe you could kind of say that with Ed too. You know, Ron got Ed thinking about it. Chris sort of had that relationship and kind of maintained it. And I guess I just kind of came in and said, Ed, what do you want to do? How do you want to make an impact? This is what we can do.
And, you know, perspective is interesting. So I don't remember exactly. It must have been maybe 3 years or so when we made the commitment to three.
2 years ago, maybe. I think, Ed, 19, November 19.
Yeah, because COVID kind of took 2 years out of everybody's life. But but it's funny, interesting. My father-in-law passed away. They were living in Georgia. And so my mother-in-law moved here in 2016 into an independent living facility. So if you don't think that your life is finite, go to an independent living facility, and she's 88 now, and look at all the women that are there with no men. And you realize at that point in time, I'm not going to be here forever. So it makes you start to really think about that and say, well, okay, maybe I should prepare better for that rather than just stick my head in the sand, you know, act like I'm going to be here for a long time and see what happens.
I've discovered over the years that many individuals that we don't know that we're in their estate, that Drexel College of Engineering is in their estate. And I think that's another good sort of advice to give is, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask, to say, hey, are we in your estate? Have you thought about including us in? You'll be surprised what people say or come back with. I've had people say, oh yeah, like we are, you know, we're your, you know, engineering's in for X amount, or, you know what, like I have been thinking about that. You know, like my wife has a scholarship at so-and-so university. Let's try and, you know, maybe create one through my bequests, you know, in my estate now. And we get gifts all the time that come in from estates that we just didn't know about. And you kind of sit back and you kick yourself a little bit and think, ah, man, like maybe I should have reached out to them, or maybe I should have did a little bit more digging around and finding out. It is sensitive, and I cannot stress that enough. And you do have to sort of gauge and figure out when that's right. And that's hard. That is hard, but you're not going to know unless you just ask and see how that conversation goes.
Ed, now that this is in place, how are you feeling?
Actually, better, actually, that I've overcome my own personal issues with Drexel. But the fact that it's settled, we actually redid our estate documents after we made that commitment, so that it's in our docs. So there's no ambiguity there in terms of, you know, what's going to happen later. I feel pretty good. The other thing that I do feel that Tom did very well, and I understand, I mean, there must be, you know, you must have annual targets for current cash as opposed to future cash. And in my case, it's a futures arrangement. I got no pressure from Tom to make it a short-term thing. It was the fact that pressure didn't come, and you know what we were willing to do, or what we were willing to do, was fine. And Tom's willing to play the long game there. Actually, made me feel very good. Actually,
I think having someone like Ed who was willing to, you know, overcame his, you know, the problems and the sort of the sour taste in his mouth from what happened back when he was a student, you know. You're busy during the time when you're working from, you know, your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And then you start to then think about, once you get into, I talked to individuals in their 50s and 60s, you start to think about their legacy, and they think about what's going to happen when they pass. Where's this, you know, they've been very fortunate in their careers, but they've made a good amount of money they can allocate and put aside. Ed has been a wonderful example, and I can share with others and kind of inspire them to do the same.
If you'll play along with me for a minute, could we play a little game of do and don't? So Ed, starting with you from a donor perspective, what are the things when a gift officer is approaching a potential donor that they should do, and the things that they absolutely should not do?
You know, it's really only one do. You know, do it the low pressure way worked for me anyway. And the don't is, don't be afraid to ask for the order, you know?
Tom, from your perspective as a fundraiser, what are the do's and don'ts when working with donors?
I mean, Ed was pretty spot on there. Your do, you ask, you know, ask and listen. I think too many times gift officers don't listen, or they don't pick up on certain, you know, details. And what I mean by that is, you know, listen, they talk about traveling. Great. Do they have a second home somewhere, a third home somewhere? What are their philanthropic, you know, passions? Do they donate to other organizations? One little trick I like to do is, you know, I'll ask somebody, where else do you donate towards? Where else are you philanthropic towards? Ed, I don't even think I asked you that. Maybe I should ask you that sometime. But where else do you donate to? Because that could give some clues and insights into maybe where they're passionate about, or where they maybe could direct something at your organization, you know, towards. Don't assume anything. Absolutely do not assume anything, whether that be the research that you have in your database on the individual, what, you know, they may be rated, say, I don't know how other institutions, you know, do rating wise, but maybe they're rating like gift capacity from 10,000 to 25,000. I've seen it before where that's complete bogus, and this individual is rated way higher and has a capacity that's way higher. I've also seen the reverse where someone's been really rated high, and frankly, they don't have any money left, or they're just not, they're not philanthropic, and that's okay. I think that's also important to say that is okay if somebody's not philanthropic with your organization or doesn't want to give. It's going to happen. You know, you're not every single solitary alum from your university, they're not going to want, everyone's not going to give. We're not, you know, well, unless you're a Princeton or a Harvard, but even those institutions have individuals who don't do that. Don't assume anything. Go into a conversation with open ears and listen, just absolutely listen and try to pick up on some of those little details.
Yeah. And the only thing I would say is customization is good. It's not a one size fits all. And the notion of listening and understanding, nurturing, if that's what's required, in my case, that was, just letting it kind of play out over time. The fact that, and everybody's different. So, it being able to customize the approach and listening, and it has to be done. I think it has to be done. Pushing and pushing and pushing will work for some people, back some others off. So you just have to do horses for courses, to use a cliche,
And we're very fortunate at Drexel, all of us in this institution, gift officers, that our leader, David Unruh, he is awesome. He's an awesome individual. He's an awesome guy who never, ever pushes us. He goes, never push us to go. He always says, if you know these your individual prospects better than anybody, he goes, if you think the time isn't right, then I trust you. But if you think the time is right to do it, then go for it. He will never, never push us. And so, Ed, that comes really from the top down, that sort of no pressure. And it's a philosophy that I hope, and that other gift officers who listen to this and fundraisers can take to their respective institutions.
Guys, this is a really great turnaround. Thinking about the end of Ed's experience at Drexel with the financial aid to now making a legacy gift that's going to be impacting students for years to come. So thank you for sharing the turnaround with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's recap the key takeaways from Tom and Ed. Number one, before you can overcome a bad experience, you got to find out what went wrong. Let your prospect know that you'd like to understand what happened. Then listen. Number two, if you're new to a territory, like when Tom picked up Arizona, use it as an opportunity to reset relationships between alumni in the university or potential donors in your organization. Number three, just like Tom did, listen for clues about your donors' interests and passions. For Tom and Ed, it's Philly sports. They share that passion and could use that to build a genuine relationship. Four, have patience. If you're coming back from a bad experience, it's going to take time to rebuild trust between the donor and the organization. In this case, three gift officers. And then number five, when you're at the point of talking about a gift, find the right opportunity. For Ed, that was Operation Graduation for the College of Engineering, a way to really come full circle, supporting current students so they won't face the same situation Ed did when he was an undergrad. Talk about an amazing turnaround. Our next episode launches in a week. We get inside the head of a millennial major donor and successful CEO as we talk corporate giving with Andrew Koenig, president of City Furniture. It's double the fun because Andrew is bringing along City's VP of Community Relations, Lindsay LeBlanc. She's the one who handles all those donation requests. And Lindsay's going to open up and share the keys for fundraisers to successfully approach businesses. Hey, thanks so much for joining us for No More, Raise More. I'm your host, Jennifer Trammell.